Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm delighted to speak today with four guests about the collection that was recently published, The Burden of the Past, History, Memory, and Identity in Contemporary Ukraine, published by Indiana University Press in 2020. I'm happy to welcome Anna Wiligawa, one of the editors of the volume. She's assistant professor at the Institute of Philosophy and Sociology, Polish Academy of Sciences. She's author of Displaced Memories, Remembering and Forgetting in Post-War Poland and Ukraine. Anna Abakunova, former associate tutor at the University of Sheffield and the Yaroslav and Nadia Mihaychuk Research Fellow in Ukrainian Studies at the Ukrainian Research Institute, Harvard University. She's co-author of The Genocide and Persecution of the Roma and Sinti, Bibliography and Historiographical Review, published by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance in 2016. Currently, she's an independent researcher, and she's working on her monograph about the self-rescue and rescue of Roma and Jews in Ukraine during the Holocaust. Matthew Pauly is Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University. He's author of Breaking the Tongue, Language, Education, and Power in Soviet Ukraine, 1923-1934. Matt and I talked about this book on this channel in 2016. Daria Mattingly is Leven-Hume, early career fellow at University of Cambridge, where she teaches in Soviet history. Her current book project focuses on Jews in the Holodomor. Hello, everyone. Welcome. And first of all, congratulations on the volume. When I first saw the title of the volume, it immediately piqued my interest, not only because memory studies and cultural memory is my research interest, but also because the volume is quite an innovative work. Memory studies has experienced a boom over the last few decades. However, the topics that you bring up and the way you discuss them are rather new for Ukrainian studies in particular. You initiate conversation about how tragic, traumatic topics can be approached, not only locally, but globally as well. Would you share your experience on or working on this book? What was the driving force and what would you like to communicate with this volume? And I believe this first question will be for Anna.
Thank you, Natalia, for bringing all of us together to this interview. I really appreciate your time. I think that as many other volumes of that kind, this book began with a meeting, with a workshop, exactly that we had in Warsaw, I believe in 2014. And that was a workshop devoted to the memory studies in Ukraine and in Belarus originally, but not so many scholars working with Belarus arrived. So finally, we had a workshop devoted almost exclusively to Ukrainian studies in field of memory. And of course, we didn't had the volume in mind when starting the workshop, but then it happened that the workshop proved to be very interesting, and Daria and Anna attended the workshop, but also only three participants of the workshop became authors of the volume. because we realized that somehow the general topic of memory studies in Ukraine is, of course, too broad, and we are thinking about how to narrow it and how to make it interesting and specific. And we decided to go for discussing the difficult past. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is really a broad definition, and it's quite often overused. But we had a feeling that for Ukraine, it's really, really important. And it somehow explains what's happening in with Ukrainian past and how the past is used and misused. So we decided to invite some other scholars and to focus on issues that we found particularly interesting and relevant for this issue of difficult past or difficult memory. And this, of course, brings us to the second question of you. So what we wanted to communicate, what this book was meant for. And I would say that we wanted to show how important still past and memory is in contemporary Ukraine, even comparing with other countries of Central and Eastern Europe. And there are some reasons for why this this past and this difficult memory is important. And I would start with the first one, which is, I think, quite visible in our volume. So past is not only a past in Ukraine, and I would say that it's still so much connected with, of course, with memory, with identity, but also with nation building, with state building, and with politics, which is not, no, it's not in our title, but I still think that politics is really, really involved in what's happening. And the second issue is the internal diversity of Ukraine. And of course, there are many countries in Europe, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, which share this feature of being so diverse in terms of historical experience. But what's different for Ukraine is that Ukrainian regions or parts of Ukraine which have different historical experience are not left alone with dealing with this experience. And when we were organizing the workshop, it was 2014, so it was already after the annexion of Crimea and so on and so on. And we really had this feeling that, well, it's happening. The past is used in politics and is influencing the lives of like normal average people. Mm-hmm. So again, all countries, all nations or societies have to take under account their neighbors when dealing with their own difficult past. But situation in Ukraine is quite specific because there is still a war, and not only necessity to take under account your neighbor and to deal with this relationships in terms of a dialogue, academic life or so. Mm-hmm. So basically, this is what we had in mind when working with this volume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Anna. Your statement about 2014 as the time period when the past was brought back to the present and when the past was kind of replayed again really resonates with me. When I'm thinking back about those events that were taking place in 2014, I feel like some statements from the 19th century in particular were just brought to the 21st century. And Anna, Daria, Matt, did you participate in the workshop that Anna just mentioned?
I have participated, and I think only me did it among all of us. Daria.
It is, well, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Indeed.
Routine.
Yeah, I remember that there were actually many people who were listening to our presentations, and a lot of Poles who didn't know Ukrainian or Russian, but workshop was in English and Polish, and mm-hmm. many Polish people could participate, and they were very active. I still remember this workshop because for that year it was the best one in my life. And before I also didn't have so large audience, different international experience with different scholars. And also, I think that was only the second workshop where I had to submit my paper in advance. Mm. So I had a chance to work on my paper later as well and to develop it. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. actually, I'm very grateful for this to Anna and Malgorzata.
Mm-hmm. And Daria?
Yeah, I second to everything Anna just said. And indeed, the discussions were very engaging during the workshop. So as a presenter myself, I received a lot of valuable feedback and met the scholars whose books I read. And it was just an incredible event. And I wasn't surprised when Anna reached out to the participants suggesting putting a volume together mm-hmm. because so many things were discussed. And there were participants from Belarus mm-hmm. who were discussing activism. And indeed, some of them are activists who are taking part in the protests as we speak. So mm-hmm. that it was a seminal event indeed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Matt? You didn't participate.
I did not participate. Clearly, I wish I had. It sounds wonderfully engaging. I mean, obviously, those are the best conferences where papers are circulated beforehand and yes. there's an engaged Definitely. Audience. But no, I was invited. I responded to a call for papers for the volume, and I added an essay. I think that sort of rounds out the history. I think that the editors have done a remarkable job mm-hmm. In providing a really quite even treatment of different moments in Ukraine's quite troubled and contested past.
Yeah, and quite different perspectives. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, if I may add something, I just thought that quite important idea that we had somewhere behind with Małgorzata when working on the volume was that we wanted to have it both internationally recognizable with scholars who are already known in the field, but also we wanted to give the floor to scholars who are really well known in Ukraine and in Poland, but usually write in Polish or in Ukrainian, and they are not so much known abroad. And I think we did it.
Mm-hmm. So in the introduction part that you, Anna, co-authored with Malgorzata Glowacka-Griper, you refer to Oksana Shevel, who claims that Ukraine still has a chance to develop polarized regimes of memory, that is, in short, a society with pluralistic visions of the past that do not compete and do not fight with each other. Could you please elaborate on this statement a little bit?
Yes, basically, we found this notion or this definition of memory regimes really useful for our volume. And basically Oksana Shevel distinguishes three types of memory regimes, which is homogeneous one, which does not happen so often, which means that everybody shares the same historical experience, and also there are no problems with evaluation of the past and no problems with different opinion of the past. So, well, this is rather kind of theoretical type. The second one is fractured, and then there is the polarized. And polarized seems to be most wanted one because it means that, well, we have different historical experiences and But people do not need to share these experiences and this evaluation of the past and opinions of the past to live peacefully in one society. And this is what the author, what Oksana Shevel somehow wishes to everybody successful, to each successful democratic society. But then there remains this fractured memory regime, which means that that there are different historical communities of experience, and it causes problems for the society. And I would say that her statement that in Ukraine, in general, elites are fractured, which means that they fight with each other because they do not share the same vision of the past, and they want their own vision of the past to become, the one which is the ruling one. But at the same time, the society is much more similar to the pillarized memory regime, which means that for everyday life, for average people, the past is important, but not important enough to divide them and to make them fight. Mm-hmm. And I would say that from the volume, it's quite obvious that in most cases it is, as she states, and also from my own fieldwork, it comes out that yes, the past is dividing, and it might be difficult even within the families, within the local communities, within the regions, but until it's not used by the elites, people can live with these difficult historical experiences. And belonging to this difficult, to this different memory communities. And the problem is when the elites decide to mobilize average people and people who normally do not have problems with the past. So I would say that as long as the political elites belong to this fractured memory regime, it is a potential danger also to be, also because they can be these elites, they can be used by external powers, and it might cause problems mm-hmm. for the entire society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, your statement resonates with the one that you mentioned earlier about 2014, when the past was replayed again, and that past was used by some political agents, political actors. And I think that this idea about pluralistic vision of the past makes so much sense because, especially for Ukraine, because it's so diverse in terms of cultures and ethnic groups and nations. However, on the level of population, right? So we can see some common, so to speak, points or common visions. But on the political level, unfortunately, history and the past in particular are very much instrumentalized to achieve some political goals. And maybe, Matt, can you comment on the usage of the history for political purposes today in Ukraine? Maybe just a few words.
Yeah, so my essay is on Simon Petlura, and I would advance the claim, I think, that he is not a good figure for introducing the notion of a pillarized history, right? His image is just so contested, and a lot of what I investigate, I mean, I was motivated to write this essay because of my work on the 20s and 30s, and the way that Petlura became a bête noire of Ukrainian nationalism from the Soviets. And essentially what I argue is that construction of an image has an afterlife in the post-Soviet era that makes him an irredeemable figure. It doesn't mean that there shouldn't be good historical scholarship on him, nor should his merits should be investigated as well. Obviously, in the contemporary moment, Petlura has been called upon by those advocating for a strong defiance of Russia's sponsorship of rebels in southeastern Ukraine, and it's natural, I think, that one looks towards his image. But for a whole portion of the of Ukraine's population that grew up in the Soviet era, he is an uncomfortable person to use for that purpose. So I'd say it's a natural sort of grasp, but one can reference the history of the Ukrainian People's Republic as a whole and these ideas about Ukrainian assertion of its own sovereignty without highlighting Fedora. I mean, it's a difficult thing to do, but he's a problematic character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your piece is titled Simon Petlura, the Ukrainian People's Republic and National Commemoration in Contemporary Ukraine. And you also provide some examples from those images that were popular or widespread under the Soviet Union. So maybe just a few words about this comparison and about this shift from the representation of Simon Petlura in the Soviet Union and in contemporary Ukraine.
Right. So, I mean, for my work on Ukrainization that I did prior to the publication of this essay, the term Petlurist, the age of Petlura, these sorts of things were bandied around by the Soviets to essentially tar anyone that overly asserted their Ukrainianness, and it served as a caution against those that were still in Soviet Ukraine that were recruited for the process of Ukrainization, that is, promotion of Ukrainian culture and language, that had a past in the Ukrainian People's Republic. So it meant to warn them to be careful about what they said, and they could be quickly associated with a past that was taboo by the invocation of the term Petlurist. I talk in the essay, and maybe one moment that I think is quite instrumental of what I'm talking about. So it carries on, there are several individuals who were associated with Ukrainianization that are arrested as part of this Union for Liberation of Ukraine trial. And one of the chief charges made against them is that they held a requiem for Petlura, a secret requiem for Petlura in St. Sophia after Petlura's assassination in 1926. And what has happened in the post-Soviet era is there actually was this sort of requiem, an event probably that never occurred, but Ukrainians who want to memorialize his memory did so all the same. There's been, particularly in, I argue that this process of contesting Petlura and promoting Petlura has a long range perspective to it. The push for commemoration of Petlura really began under Yushchenko, under President Yushchenko, beginning in 2004. And one could say among intellectuals and historians, even before then, and sort of nationally minded activists. But those who oppose him never disappeared, and there's calls against his commemoration become more strident over the course of time, particularly under Yushchenko. So, so those who want to memorialize him, those who were present at this, in fact, requiem that occurred, faced real opposition, particularly in the more I suppose leftist press in Ukraine. It's not just that. Of course, Petlura is accused of being responsible for pogroms against Jews in 1919 for Western Ukraine. He's not a particularly savory figure because he signed this treaty with Poland, which essentially forfeited Western Ukraine to the Poles, and so opposition to him doesn't just come from the political left and those who would valorize, I suppose, the Soviet narrative of him as an arch enemy of the people's cause in Ukraine in the Soviet time.
And for memory studies, one of these basic fundamental issues is what's the difference between history and memory. So what's the difference between history and memory for you as a historian?
I mean, history, to me, we simply need to know what happened. And so there are absolutely great works of scholarship on Dolores' role, for example, in issuing calls to Ukrainian soldiers and the like not to engage in pogroms and condemnation of these sorts of things. And then there's been new calls for a more rigorous study of the context of his assassination in Paris. All that stuff, I think, is the good work of historians. Memory for me is, I suppose, a way in which history can be made operational. And if you forgive the term, it may not be this way, but I think it is, at least in the case that I'm talking about, can be weaponized for a particular cause. And then memory, I make this distinction between functional memory and storage memory in my essay. There's a functional memory, which I suppose is this operational type of memory, and then memory that persists in the minds of those who either experienced events or learned a history that was different than the sort of propagandistic history that they were taught by the Soviets. And I suggest that storage memory of Petlura as the leader of what many Ukrainians consider to be a noble cause, the Ukrainian People's Republic, got in the way of what the Soviets were doing, has carried over to this day and motivates this attempt at commemoration. But it still has to deal with a very strong storage memory also from the Soviet era, right? So there's a functional memory that the Soviets employ, and then in the post-Soviet era, mm-hmm. that becomes a sort of storage memory that carries over mm-hmm. into the present time.
Well, thank you, Matt.
Sure.
Anna, you wrote about the Roma collective memory in your piece, Extermination of the Roma in Transnistria during World War II, Construction of the Roma Collective Memory. This is a very interesting topic, and the way you approach it is rather new as well. How personal memories can develop into collective memory, furthermore, how collective memory can become some basis for the consolidation of a community, ethnic group, and further nation. Would you guide us through your main argument as well as through your topic, which focuses on the Roma?
Okay. So the paper was written in 2014 and then developed through a couple of years. And since then, I a little bit changed, actually, my perception of the Roma communities in Ukraine and their memory and the events of last 2 years show more active participation of the Roma communities in commemoration, in defense of human rights and so on. So I'm not sure that what was written in 2014 can be applied 100% now. And this is the problem with academia, actually, that all our research are published quite late. Mm-hmm. So the actual fieldwork was done in 2010-12. The piece was written in 2014, and publication itself came out early 2020.
That's almost 8 years, yeah.
Yeah, so then in the article, in that chapter, I analyzed the Roma memory, individual and collective, through three different dimensions. It's like everyday life dimensions, socio-political dimension, and historical. And what I tried to show is that first, It's not easy to research Roma communities at all because they are quite close and they don't want, in most cases, and don't allow non-Roma to enter their community. Mm-hmm. And even some Roma who are not from communities still have different difficulties to research other Roma communities because they are different. Second is that even with all those complications, I managed to take some interviews with the Roma, and I see that traces of memory are still. Their memory still contain traces of memory of those events because they were too traumatic and too tragic. And in this sense, then Roma are not different from Jews, for example, who survived the same deportations of Transnistria and the annihilation, or from Ukrainians who survived Holodomor. On the other hand, Roma don't want to tell the same experience as Jews want. Mm-hmm. And another thing that, of course, political events very much influence the Roma way to tell their stories and to participate, so-called participation in common life with others. What I mean participation in common life with others, it means that Roma more and more go to different events on commemoration. They participate and create different NGOs, which not only fight for their rights, but also try to promote historical past for future learning, and try to collect or engage Roma scholars, first of all, scholars of Roma origin, to learn their past and to transmit Roma perception of history to the world, let's say, to others, researchers, not Roma researchers, and research communities. In this sense, what I have written in my chapter in 2014, it's quite changed now, because we can see a couple of very important Roma researchers of the Holocaust and the Roma deportations in Transnistria, like Adrian Fortuna, who is Roma, who has Roma origin, or Ionida Costache, who research music in Roma music in Romania, and also deportations of Roma in Transnistria, and Ion Duminica from Moldova, who is a Roma origin and who is in Academy of Science of Moldova. So it happened, like, obviously not immediately, but through process. But in comparison with 2014, now we have completely different situation. Another thing that, from historical perspective, I compared the Roma genocide, which I think can be called genocide, even though it's juridically not yet, with the Holocaust of the Jews. And what I argued is that the Roma annihilation is not forgotten, how many researchers claim, because time to time this topic appears in public space, in journalist articles, in academia. But again, if to compare with 2014, now it's more and more popular, so-called popular, I mean, among researchers. It started to be very interesting because also new archives were open. For example, in Ukraine, the former KGB archive now is accessible and many documents are available, but of course, it's difficult to find documents about the Roma, but still possible. So the situation has changed. And the main argument of my chapter is as well has changed. So I still think that Roma don't want in at large to provide their stories, like to open their memories to non-Roma. I still think that political influence is at large has a great impact on Roma communities, but not only negative, but also positive mm-hmm. for involvement mm-hmm. of the Roma into academia and other areas of studies of the Roma or promotion of their culture. But also I think that if to compare with the Holocaust of the Jews, there are more relevancy now because we have more documents. And the main thing that Roma still don't receive any compensations or only a few number of Roma receive compensations from Germans and former collaborators of Germans for the deportations, I mean Roma deportations, Roma extermination, whereas the Jews widely use this opportunity. So also this unjust attitude has to be corrected. And in this sense, it's a little different what I argued in the article.
Mm-hmm. So where did you do your field work?
So I had a couple of field works, and last one I did in 2016. After this, I didn't do any field works because actually the age of the informants already is too old, that they become too old and they cannot respond any more questions due to their physical or mental situation. Mm. So I did in Ukraine and Moldova, in Bessarabia part, or Ukrainian Bessarabia and Moldova. Some respondents I found in Soroka and Kishinev in Moldova, and most of the respondents were from Odessa, Mykolaiv, and Vinnytsia area. So exactly, I tried to cover all Transnistria region. So many Roma from those whom I interviewed didn't live or were not born before the war exactly on those places, but they were deported there or they survived there. So for my chapter, for my research, that was the main thing, that I interviewed people of Roma origin who survived in Transnistria, even though they were not born or didn't live before they were there. Mm-hmm. So and it covered entire Transnistria territory. Mm-hmm.
And you also mentioned that usually the Roma communities do not want to share or to communicate, to tell the same story. Why?
It's very difficult to explain in a couple of minutes. There are different reasons. One of them that in most cases the Roma communities are closed communities. So again, to talk about Roma, we cannot talk to them as one group of people. Like, for example, we can talk about the Jews. The Roma are divided into groups, subgroups, and even further to very little communities. For example, in Izmail, which is Odessa Oblast, I found three Roma communities which were hostile to each other. Mm. And each of them tried to talk about the Second World War. I mean, representatives of each of them tried to talk about the Second World War in different manners to show, for example, that their survival was more difficult than others' community. Mm-hmm. So we see here this competition of victims. Mm-hmm. So why they don't want to talk to researchers? First of all, the attitude to Gajo, non-Roma, is not positive attitude because they don't know Roma culture, Romanes, and they're not ours for Roma, yeah? If we talk that from the perspective of Roma, Gajo are not ours, they're different. Even some Roma who don't speak Romanes, they're also perceived as Gajo. in many cases. I talked to some researchers, for example, whom I mentioned, Ion Dominica, and he told me that he doesn't speak Romanes well, and some Roma communities don't tell him all stories. And another thing is that they don't trust researchers because they don't know what to expect from them. So somebody arrives, asks questions, and then what? So I noticed in my interviews that Roma always, in all cases, tried to hint that they want something as a replacement for their stories. It can be not always some material things or money, or it can be just sharing of some personal stories with them after the interview, or they can tell something what they cannot tell during the interview. So it's not some always material things. It can be some psychological demand, some need for good word, but in some cases it's also money or some food or something. They ask what will be in return. Some of them just ask directly what I will get in return. So, and what I'm thinking, that the best way to research Roma, it's actually a way of anthropologists who live in one small community for a couple of months or even years, and they can observe how Roma interact with each other, which stories they tell each other, what they remember from the past, how they transmit their memories. And this person, of course, should know local dialect of Romanes, its first thing, and some traditions, and this person should be accepted by the community, because in this case, the person becomes a community member. So many things which are shared with him would be not thought that, okay, we share this with Gajo or somebody else. So I didn't use anthropological approach. I used oral history approach. I arrived one time. I took one interview and tried to get as much information as possible. Only the thing that always I asked the head of the community or person known in the community to introduce me. And that helped a little bit.
I see. Thank you. Thank you, Anna. Daria, your piece, Idle, Drunk, and Good for Nothing, Cultural Memory of the Rank and File Perpetrators of the 1932-1933 Famine in Ukraine, focuses on the men and women who facilitated the mass famine. How are they portrayed in cultural memory, and what does this portrayal communicate regarding the perpetrators and the crime to the contemporary generation?
Thank you for the question. And I think the answer could be found both in the title of the volume and in the title of my article. And I wanted to add to the point that Matt made in his chapter, that memory of Petlura is persistent. It doesn't finish with the death of Petlura. And I could see that when I was working on the perpetrators, because in my chapter, I look at identifiable traces as well as memory, and I argue there is a discrepancy. So I did find that perpetrators sometimes described their victims in 1932-33 as well as the purges of 1937 as Petlurites or Petlurists, even if these victims were, and there was no evidence to suggest they were Petlurites or indeed took part in the Ukrainian People's Republic. But nevertheless, this cliche, this tag was attached to the enemies. And yes, indeed, in my chapter, I argued that in cultural memory, this trope, there are three different modalities, how these perpetrators are described, they are not representative of the demographics, of the activities, of the experiences of the perpetrators of the famine and on the lower level. And I argue in my work, and my argument hasn't changed since then, that it was ordinary people at extraordinary circumstances. Of course, there were sadists, there were criminals, there were fanatics, but there were ordinary people that followed orders. And here I do compare the Holodomor to other cases of mass violence and genocides. And indeed, there are many, many similarities as well as cultural memory. This is nothing new because of the burden of the memory is of such a traumatic past. People and in culture, they try to make sense of it, and it's difficult to explain, oh yes, we all are capable of horrible things and committing horrible things. So sometimes we blame it on the other, on abnormal types, and hence idle, drunk, and good for nothing, as well as ideology. But it doesn't explain mass violence because, as in the Holocaust and in pogroms that were already mentioned, people take part, many people do take part, otherwise there wouldn't be mass cases of mass violence. And they do take part for different, a myriad of reasons and motivations. And yes, so I argue that description of perpetrators usually is reduced to either fanatics, and this is Soviet culture, Soviet literature, museums and historiography. It changed somewhat in 1960s when we have de-Stalinization. So sometimes the blame is put squarely at the feet of Stalin and his henchmen. But nevertheless, Soviet is quite consistent, describing that they were unflinching Bolsheviks, they were working for the greater good. And then there is post-Soviet Ukrainian prose and works that were created in diaspora. And yes, of course, in this case, cultural memory is as of perpetrators is idle, drunk. They are savage. They are cruel, sadistic. And this is actually, I would argue, the most dominant trope modality that exists today. And with a few cases that I mentioned in my chapter, dissident literature, when Vasily Grossman, Yevhen Hutsala, they investigate, explore the ordinary person and their experience. And sometimes they're compromised into perpetration because they worry for their family, they would starve, or there are different insecurities that are used against people. But unfortunately, it's not a dominant discourse. So yes, my argument hasn't changed, and what I wrote in the article, and Anna helped me to put it together. She allowed me some revisions because I was honing it during those years before publication. So it stayed the same, and this is what I just described in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just mentioned some dissident literature and how perpetrators are probably presented or portrayed there. And I'm wondering how we identify a perpetrator. Not only in terms of morals, right? But I think it's easier to identify a perpetrator in terms of history or some criminal principles. But in terms of morals, how do we manage this kind of concept? Because I think the boundaries are so blurry.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. Because the boundaries are very porous, and today's perpetrator can become a victim tomorrow and vice versa. And indeed, it is very difficult to identify them. As a historian, and Matt already mentioned that, I have to answer the question of what and why, mm-hmm. and so how I identify them. So I, on the ground level, I look at the district officials who leveraged all the orders down to activists and officials on the village level. So if they are officials, like chairman or chairwoman, but rarely, of the collective farm, that's definitely a perpetrator. Sometimes they would be actually saving people. They would use their position to save, but that was not in the majority of cases. Collective farm, village council, And the activists or brigades that were doing the house searches from house to house, they would be requisitioning grain and foodstuffs, and those are perpetrators on the ground. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking at trained perpetrators like GPU or security service agents, because certainly they are perpetrators, and militia or police. And sometimes army was employed as well as pioneers and Komsomol to guard the fields during summer of 1933 and earlier on in spring as well. So, and various institutions at various times were employed as well. For example, Oso Aviahim, Otso Aviahim in Ukrainian, this militarized youth organization, they were also employed. So, as long as they were involved in enforcing the policies of extraction of grain on the ground, they could be qualified as perpetrators. Whether motivation, whether they were compromised or not, we are looking at the end of their actions. If you take food away from a person, you are a perpetrator, because mm-hmm. it's pretty much condemning somebody to starvation. So yes, it's very tricky to identify somebody. And that's why throughout the chapter, I try to avoid passing any moral judgment, because despite interdisciplinarity, you have to stay as an observer. And that's why it helped when I was doing field work, going to the villages, that I had no connection to. And yes, I was an outsider, but I was not passing the judgment, and I could talk to various groups, descendants of perpetrators. And in one case, it was a perpetrator who was a 15 at the time, mm-hmm. and as well as victims. And they were telling completely different stories. Some are very, what we say, gruesome, but otherwise very revealing what it felt like to be involved.
Mm-hmm. And where did you do your field work? What oblasts?
Yes, I went to, I started with memoirs of Soviet dissident Kopylov. And he described and he named, actually, the villages where he worked. And I went to those villages, and there, I didn't only do this field work trips, I also went to the archives to get some background information on the villages. Mm-hmm. So I done my homework before actually talking to the people. I realized that he was telling me his own story, which didn't correspond to what people in the village locals were telling me, as well as security service reports on him were telling some other details, which becomes this of what Anna already mentioned earlier in the introduction on the Vlegala and Margajata, that there is this differences in memory, how people do remember, and it all coexists. And this is what makes this research interesting for historians.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Daria. And my final question, which I would like to address to everyone, is somehow connected with the comment that Daria just mentioned about past being a burden. So in Ukraine, cultural memory studies is still quite a new field, particularly in terms of specific case studies, which help illustrate, in fact, how memorial practices work. However, there is a lot of interest towards how the individuals and the nation in general remember events and what these narratives can help us understand in terms of how a society can be presented locally and globally. And I think, Daria, your response right now confirmed this kind of overlap of the individual and the collective. So the volume is titled The Burden of the Past. Why burden? So because it really has this kind of heavy feeling, pessimistic, maybe to some extent tragic, traumatic. And I would like everyone to comment on your understanding, interpretation of this title. Maybe we can start with Anna.
Yes, I should probably start with saying that, of course, the title refers to Katrin Vanner's The Burden of the Dreams, which is a really classical book on Ukraine. And we had this book somehow in mind when working on the volume. And, well, in fact, I think that this kind of past that we were working on in this volume is a burden that you can't just leave behind, right? Because literally, burden is you can leave behind and you can go further, right? In that case, you can't, because it's will not disappear, even though you might pretend that it's not existing. It will exist and it will so of course it would be much easier for Ukrainian people not to have all these issues of life. And of course, first and foremost, all these difficulties in judging the past with Russia, right? So this all remains a burden that should be worked through, and it can be not achieved in ways other than discussing, dialoguing. We didn't want to sound pessimistic when planning the title. I still believe that there are great chances to solve, maybe not all and not right now, but just solve most of these difficult issues, and then they stop being a burden, and then and they might, constitute a good basis, good ground for they need to be looked after and solved. And this is why burden.
So maybe we should change the way we think about a burden. It's not something pessimistic, but it's something that we have to work with. Thank you, Anna. Matt?
I would agree with that sentiment that you just raised. That certainly was a thought that was shaping my thinking as I was thinking about how to respond to you. I mean, I would view burden as not necessarily a burden on the individual memory, although it certainly can shape that memory. But burden really speaks to this notion of collective memory and myth making in the present, right? One individual or group of individuals aspires to cast a different story into the public square, there is another memory that competes and pulls it back. So I suppose I would think of burden as this sort of weight. I end the essay, however, with this firm assertion that in my case, in the discussion of Fedora, one need not be forever tied to the Soviet historiography of this person, right? But you have to acknowledge that it exists and that it has an influence, and that the memory of Fedora has a dynamic existence in the present that has, I suppose, one foot in the Soviet interpretation of his place in Ukrainian history, but has a life beyond that interpretation as well.
Yes, very true. So this stage of recognizing, acknowledging, and accepting of what happened in the past and how we can deal with it in the present is, I think, is very important. Thank you, Matt. Anna?
For me, when I worked on my chapter and first time I saw the title of the book, The Burden of the Past, I immediately referred this in my mind to the fate of people, individuals who told me their stories, the Roma who survived and whole life had this burden to think what have happened, why it had happened. How to tell about it in the community and to their own children and then grandchildren, and how to deal with it. And this is real psychological burden, individual burden for those people. So it's what I was thinking immediately.
So in other words, there is this overlap of the individual and the collective as well, and there are different ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Anna. Daria?
I would add only that, I already mentioned about the burden being speaking to my chapter in particular, and this is why I think it is important to have such volumes, such collections mm-hmm. of discussions of the bird and different cases of traumatic past in mm-hmm. Ukrainian history, to make sense of the past and to understand why it happened, what happened, and why it happened. Mm-hmm. And this is the way forward, so that such traumatic memories would not be instrumentalized and used in the politics as much as they are today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you so much, Daria. Yes, I also believe that this volume is very important for many, many reasons. But in the first place, because it somehow maintains, sustains, and also encourages conversations about those pasts that Ukraine has. And it's some sort of this conversation that should be not only sustained, but we should move forward talking about this past. Because being open, right, being open about those tragic and traumatic events is very important for how we build our country further and how we try to, if that sounds a little bit romantic and idealistic, that's fine, but for consolidating the nation around these multiple visions of the past and keeping these pasts open and available to the... I think it's quite an interesting approach that you took with this volume, pointing out different facts and putting them together into this narrative. Well, I would like to thank everyone. Thank you, Anna, Daria, Matt, Anna. Thank you so much for your time today. And of course, congratulations on this important volume. And thank you for your research.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Natalia.
Thank you, Natalia.
Today, I spoke with the contributors of The Burden of the Past, History, Memory, and Identity in Contemporary Ukraine, published by Indiana University Press in 2020. Thank you for listening to New Books in East European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.